Okay, well, we've reached chapter 13. I'm working on a kind of summary so that we can see the development of Paul's argument. And I have it through the first 11 chapters, and I will eventually put it in the additional material. But now that we've moved to chapters 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, we're really into the practical application of what Paul had the foundation that he laid in the first 11 chapters. So at some point, we'll do a little review to make sure that we follow the continuity. You know, it's hard when you only meet a couple of times a week to see how what he says in chapter one is still a part of the theme of what he's doing in chapter 13. So we'll have to work on that sort of summary maybe the next time or afterwards to make sure that we're still tracking with the fact that this is one letter to one audience. But now in chapter 13, we get to one of the most, I wouldn't say controversial, but certainly one of the most misinterpreted verses in all of Paul's writing. And I put in the additional material my comments from December of 2010, where I talk about Mark Nanos's commentary on the book of Romans. It's called The Mystery of Romans, where he argues, I think, with a compelling argument that Paul is not talking about civil authority. He's not talking about the government, that he's still within the context of the synagogue. And as a result of that, his statements should be interpreted within that context. It's not as though he suddenly is distracted from what he's talking about in chapter 12 about submitting your obligation to act as a living sacrifice within the community. And suddenly he starts talking about the government as a whole, which is the way the church has interpreted it. But I think that Nanos is correct, that these comments should still be read within the synagogue community. So I want to take a few comments from this article that I wrote some years ago that I think will help set the stage for what's going to happen in the rest of 13, because 13:1 through about verses 8 or 9 is all in relation to this process of, or this problem of authority in the community. Okay? So if you've got the article and if you read the article from the additional materials, you will see that one of the things that I claim is that Paul's objective, and this is a citation, Paul's objective is to create a witness to the truth of Messiah, of Yeshua as Messiah, by encouraging Gentile converts to live Torah obedient lives, thereby causing the Jews to be jealous of the relationship these Gentiles enjoy and desire it for themselves. Now, we saw that before. We had a long conversation about the difference between jealousy and envy. But I think it's important here to recognize that what Paul addresses to the Gentiles also has an impact on the Jews. And Lise raised the question. Her question is, the views of the Jews Jews already are Torah observant. So what exactly will make them jealous? The willingness of the Gentiles to follow Torah, which would bring awe to God's mercies. Today, Jews are quite wary of Christians trying to practice Torah. And that's true 2,000 years later. But for Paul, this is first century. So what has he got in mind? And I think that Paul has the following in mind. You have a Gentile population that the Orthodox community believes the only way that they could come into a proper relationship with the Jewish God was through proselytizing, right? Which means that they had to literally convert to Judaism and go through those steps before they would have the proper relationship with Yahweh. Okay. Now, Paul says, no, that's not the case. It wasn't even the case for Abraham, that Abraham came into his relationship with God on the basis of that he had a trusting obedience to follow God, right? It wasn't that Torah came first. It was that Torah came afterwards. His trusting reliance on God came first. And what he's saying is, the Gentiles are coming into your synagogue relationship on the same basis that Abraham came in. They're coming in because of their trusting reliance on Yeshua the Messiah. If they act in ways that you, as the Orthodox community, recognize are the manifestations of a Torah obedient life, then you should also recognize that their entry into the community didn't come about because of proselytizing. It came about because of this, it came about exactly the same way that Abraham's relationship with God was developed. And therefore, you should see in them the very things that God is asking of you, right? Why would that make you jealous? Because you would say, wait a minute, that kind of relationship belongs to me, the Jew. It doesn't belong to the Gentile. The Gentiles are the people outside of the community. But now the Gentiles are acting in ways that exemplify the very best of my understanding of Torah obedience, and they seem to have a relationship with the God of Israel, who is my God. So I would say, wait a minute, how did that happen? And for Paul, that witness is the evidence that the Gentile connection to the Messiah is the same as Abraham's connection to Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, right? So what he's saying is, if you see that kind of thing happening, you have to recognize that somehow Yeshua, the relationship that they have with Yeshua, is causing them to come into the same community that you have with the God of Israel. So two things happen. First, you recognize that the God of Israel has opened the door to the Gentiles. And second, you recognize that Yeshua must be the Messiah, because they wouldn't be coming into the relationship that you have with the God of Israel unless Yeshua was bringing them into that relationship. So their claim that they are now members of the synagogue on the basis of their connection with Yeshua proves that Yeshua is the Messiah, which is what Paul's intention is, right? He wants to show that as a result of what's happening with the Gentiles, they have to accept the fact that Yeshua has something to do with the connection to their God, and therefore they have to recognize him as not the outsider, but as the true representative of God, okay? Lisa's second question is, she quotes from my article, Paul's argument was that both Jews and Gentiles receive the status of righteousness before God as a result of God's grace. However, did we not see that righteousness in Hebrew thought is linked to Torah obedience? How can a Gentile be considered righteous if he's not following Torah? But the whole point of Paul's argument in chapter 4 is Torah obedience follows righteousness. Torah obedience follows God's acceptance of the trusting relationship that the Gentile or that Abraham has. And so I would expect Torah obedience to follow my acceptance of and my gratitude for what God has done, right? So the Judaizers in the letter to the Galatians, who claim that you couldn't have a relationship with Yahweh until you passed the Torah obedience test, Paul is saying, no, that's not the case. It wasn't the case with Abraham, and it's not the case with these Gentiles. The trusting relationship that they have is enough to initiate their entrance into the community, and as a result of that, they will learn Torah and become Torah obedient, because that's their expression of gratitude for what God has done for them. And it's independent of the entrance requirement of Torah. The entrance requirement of Torah, Paul's saying, is not what God had in mind. What God had in mind is the trusting relationship. And once that occurs, then the rest follows. Now, why is that important to chapter 13? Because if we read chapter 13 in that context, it changes how we understand the word authority. And that's, I think, what Nanos is after, right? So Nanos says, and I'm going to give you some examples from this article that I wrote. He says, Paul's concern was that Gentiles should not be excluded from fellowship with God because they did not become Jews, and that the behavior following the conversion of the Gentiles would not alienate Jews from acceptance of Yeshua as Messiah. So two things happening. First, that the Orthodox community would accept them on the basis of trusting reliance, and that in that acceptance, they would recognize Yeshua as the Messiah. Then he goes on to say, the Gentiles who concluded that Torah obedience did not matter failed to recognize the difference between salvation, grace, and redemptive purpose, usefulness. And that's the basis of this discussion now in 13 and 14, right? Paul is no longer talking about Gentiles who need to be saved. He's talking about Gentiles who need to understand that the purpose of Torah obedience is the purpose of creating a community that becomes a magnetic attraction for the world. Exactly what God had in mind at Sinai, right? That there's a difference between salvation and redemptive purpose. The redemptive purpose is my witness to the world. Salvation is what God does for me so that I, in gratitude, live according to his instructions so that the world will see my relationship to him and be attracted to it. Okay? And then I say, consequently, the witness of the Gentiles would be diminished and the Jews would dismiss Yeshua as the Messiah if the Gentiles don't act in ways that honor the Jewish commitment to Torah observance. Okay, so that's what's going to happen in 13. Let me see, what else do I want to say about this article? Okay, the last part of the article says, it's talking about the same metaphorical use in Hebrews 4:12. And what I say is this, Nanos points out that Paul's metaphorical use of armor in Romans 13:12 provides evidence that the entire passage is to be taken metaphorically, especially since the phrase proper behavior in verse 13 is literally walk decently, a clear reference to a Jewish description of Torah observance. Okay? So in summary, Nanos recognizes that Paul's primary objective in the reconciliation of believing Gentiles and Jews is to create this unity of expression so that the Gentiles recognize and honor the Jewish commitment, and the Jews recognize that the Gentiles are pursuing the same kind of commitment, even though they're coming in as novices to this long tradition in history. Okay? Now, with that in mind, we need to take a serious look at what happens in 13. Okay? So I think what we've established is 13 needs to be read in the context of the synagogue, not in the context of civil government. Okay? And this makes a big, big difference in the way that we understand the verse. Okay, so let's take a look at the NASB. It first says, let every person be in subjection to the governing authorities. Okay? Now, you know that Nanos treats the governing authorities as those representatives of the governance of the synagogue, not of the governance of civil life, right? So he says, so the NASB translates, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. But from a synagogue perspective, that's absolutely true, because the authorities in the synagogue, those who are put in the position of authority by God's grace in the synagogue, are the true representatives of God's will, just as the king was supposed to be the representative of God's will. Okay? So the interesting part about this is that, and this is from my notes, Kosman, who's a world-renowned Greek scholar, distinguishes the word hupokeino, usually meaning free obedience, and hupotasthephe, which means submission to a divinely established order, right? Paul uses the word hupotasthephe, which means that he considers what's happening with the authority to be a divinely established order. But you can hardly claim that Nero is a divinely established order, right? The church wants you to believe that the civil government is in power because of God. But my argument would be that the civil government is part of the Yitzhak Hara in its unbridled attempt to gain power and is opposed to God's will, right? Why? Because everything about the civil government says that they want to replace God. So Paul can hardly be arguing that the Roman government, which was one of the most cruel governments that ever lived or that ever existed, is divinely established by God and you should submit to them. If that were the case, then no one who was Torah observant would ever be able to survive, right? Because Torah observance stands in opposition to the civil government. So it can hardly be the case that Paul is arguing that you should be in submission to the civil government. Although, obviously, the church used that to their great advantage to claim when the church was the government that you needed to submit to the church, right? The Holy Roman Empire, the et cetera, the extension of this verse into civil government. Okay. So he goes on to say, therefore, he who resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they have opposed, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. Now, let me tell you how this verse was used, and then we'll look at the Greek behind it. Okay. This verse was used as a way for the civil government to enforce its authority through a religious connection. In other words, when Constantine got a hold of this verse, he used it to basically say that if you didn't obey the emperor, you would go to hell. That's basically how he treated it, right? So he could use the power of God to send you to hell as the authority of the state to require you to conform. And pretty much the history of the church has followed that. So if you don't obey the church, or and the church is in bed with the civil government, then God will condemn you. And I no longer need an army to require you to pay your taxes. I don't need an army to enforce your compliance with the civil government. All I need is a verse from Paul that says that God's going to send you to hell if you don't comply. Okay? Obviously, Paul cannot have meant that. Yes, Phyllis.
I was just going to say this, the thing is, they can read Greek. I mean, didn't they know what he really meant and who he was really talking about, that it was the synagogue he was talking about? I mean, that works really well for them. I mean, they could use this for everything, but they knew what it really meant, right?
Yeah, back but then, you're talking about, yeah, but now you're talking about the original audience, which I believe clearly knew that Paul was talking about the Gentiles in the synagogue, because that's his whole context, right? He's writing to Gentiles who come into the synagogue. So these verses need to be applied to Gentiles within the synagogue. And the Gentiles who come into the synagogue, he's saying, you need to be under the authority of the representatives of the synagogue, right? They have an established hierarchy, an established authority, and you need to submit to it. That's what he's saying, okay? But 100 years later, when the Greek-based philosophical theologian Christians used this verse and the government of Rome was behind them, they just merely interpreted the verse as an endorsement of civil authority because it was to their advantage, right? The original audience, I'm sure, clearly understood what Nanos is saying. But from about 200 of the Common Era until today, so 1800 years or 2000 years worth, we have had the church claim that this verse is what Paul means when, and what Paul meant is that you need to be in obedience to the government. Okay? But that's a long way from what the original audience thought. What we're trying to do is capture what the original audience thought, because there's a long history of the other side. Okay? So let's take a look at verse 2 one more time. And my note is, it's impossible for Paul to exhort this audience to obey the civil authority when it was the civil authority that resisted God's Torah. This verse makes no sense at all if it is applied to any form of government, but it is certainly useful to governments who want compliance based on religious belief. Uriel's translation, and this is really interesting, because Uriel's translation of this verse is, consequently, the one who is hostile against authority defies the decree of God, and those who defy shall themselves become liable to judgment. Now, without explaining what hostile to authority means, Uriel's translation can also be accepted as an endorsement of the civil government. I think you need Nanos' comment to clearly distinguish between hostile to the authority of the synagogue and hostile to the civil authority. And I think that makes a huge difference. So let's continue. Hostile against authority uses the word exousia. Okay? The exousia is in the Septuagint, this term is used for right and authority in a legal sense, and also in a God-given sense, that is, in the law. Okay, well, what is the law? The law is Torah. So if I say hostile to authority, I'm really saying hostile to Torah, right? If Paul had written hostile to nomos instead of hostile to exousia, we would clearly know that what he means is you can't come into the synagogue and be hostile to the Mosaic Code, right? Unfortunately, he used the word exousia instead of nomos, okay? Why did he do that? Well, because in Daniel and the Maccabees, this word is used for the king or the power of God. It's used as God's power, and in the Septuagint, it introduces a term, here's the quote, excellently expressing the concept of God's unrestricted sovereignty, the God whose very word is power, and the quotation is from Daniel 4:14. So, primarily, exousia denotes the absolute possibility of action that is proper to God alone as the source of all power, okay? So if what Paul is saying is you need to be in submission to the absolute power of God, you cannot at the same time endorse a Roman Empire whose very civil laws opposed Torah obedience, right? You can't have it both ways. So Paul chooses Greek words from the Septuagint that if you understood the Septuagint, and of course this congregation does because they have the Greek Hebrew Bible, the Septuagint, right? Then they see in this word, oh, Paul's talking about the absolute sovereignty of God. So obviously you can't oppose an authority in the synagogue that represents the absolute authority of God, the absolute sovereignty of God, okay? Paul radically upholds exousia, but relates it to two principles of what is fitting and what is edifying, right? Then it's not intrinsic autonomy, but rather the freedom in God's kingdom by faith to regard what God says as the foundation for how you live. And we're right back to Torah obedience, right? So if we clearly distinguish the difference between civil and synagogue authority, we won't have the confusion that's been caused by Paul's words for the church, and we won't have the confusion of misinterpreting how Uriel translates it or how the NASB translates it. All we need to recognize is that Paul's talking about what happens to the Gentiles in the community, not outside the community. Okay? And with that in mind, now we're going to look at the rest of these verses, and they start meaning something quite different. Yes, Phyllis, you have another comment?
Just wanted to know, the Septuagint in those days, wasn't an actual book like we know it, right? Was it just a group of scrolls, or was it really like a book, like we would know a book?
I'm sorry,
The Septuagint. You had said that they had Septuagint. Was it like a book like we know a book would look like, or was it a series of scrolls like the Torah, you know?
Was it a codex or was it scrolls? I don't know. I don't know if it was translated as scrolls or if it was translated as a codex. The codex, a book. I don't know if books were even invented then. But I do know that they had bound like plates where they turned pages instead of unrolling a scroll. So I don't know. I'll have to find out. That's a good question. Okay. Okay. So let's take a look at some of the other Greek terms in this verse, right? And the first one I want to look at is who opposes the ordinances of God. Okay. And the ordinances of God, okay, if you're a Hebrew, you recognize ordinance of God, meaning precepts and laws, right? But it's interesting that even in the Greek, it doesn't say who opposes the ordinance of the government. It says the ordinances of God, right? And the word diatasso means, it's a rare word in the Septuagint, right? But it means the arrangement, the allotment, the determinations, the measure of what God says. And of course, that makes perfect sense if you're reading it from a Torah perspective. It doesn't make any sense at all if you're reading it from a civil perspective, because clearly there are laws on the books which stand in utter opposition to the Torah, right? Now look at the last part. He says, and those who have opposed will receive condemnation. And the word there is krima, which means judgment. But it's an ancient Old Testament idea that God is the judge, not that the civil authority is the judge, but that God is the one who judges. So God clearly isn't going to judge you on the basis of your obedience to the civil authority. He's going to judge you on the basis of your obedience to his instructions. Okay? And verse 3, we can see the same pattern occurring. Okay? So verse 3 of the NASB says, for rulers are not the cause of fear for good behavior. And of course, we want to know, what does the word rulers mean? Because it looks like we could, if we're the church, we could interpret that as for Caesar and all of his minions, right? But now we want to know, what does that word mean? And here's the interesting part. In Greek, the word is archon, right? A term that designates a high official, mostly in civil life, rarely in religious life, although in Nehemiah 12:7 it refers to the priests, and in Daniel 10 to the celestial beings guarding and representing the individual states. In the New Testament, there's only one place where this term is used, and you're looking at it right there. Okay? So if Paul has in mind what we know from the Torah, then he uses the word in the same way that Nehemiah and Daniel use the word, which is not about the civil authorities, but about the religious authorities. Okay? And of course, that makes perfect sense when you think that Paul has in mind how the Gentiles should act in a synagogue community. Okay? So he says, do you want to have no fear of authority? Okay? Do you do what is good and you will have the praise from them? Okay, so now here's the interesting point that Nanos makes. In no case does Paul talk about these authorities, rulers, or representatives as offices. They are people, right? They're individual people. He's not saying, do you fear the office of the president, the office of the emperor? What he's talking about is individuals within the community. And individuals within the community, of course, represent those figures within the community of the synagogue who were granted honor and respect as a result of their display of God's will in their lives, right? Might be the rabbi, might be the president of the synagogue, which we talk about today, which they may not have had that title then. But the idea is that there are people in the synagogue, people in the synagogue, not offices in the synagogue. So he says, so the word here is, the Septuagint uses the term, right, for the sense of legal status given by God, right? And Nanos uses these words about people, not institutions. So when Uriel translates this word in verse 3, he says, who are in reality ringleaders in whom there exists no reverence toward good or good conduct, but rather towards evil. Now, do you not desire to be disposed toward the administration? And Uriel treats it as a status rather than an individual. And I think that's a mistake, because what really matters to Paul are the individuals that God has put in power, in authority, to represent him, not to represent the office or the status, but to represent his sovereignty and authority over the community. Okay? So the reason I can say that is because when we use the word ordinances of God, we're talking about, we're talking about the minister of God in verse 4. For it is a minister of God for your good. Now, the NASB translates that as it, right? Doesn't translate that as he. But the interesting part about the Greek is that the term which is used there is used for a high official, not for an office. So a minister of God becomes, guess what, a word that we already know. Diakonos, which is a servant, right? We already know. So Paul is talking about a singular masculine noun, a person, not an office, a diakonos, a servant who acts on God's behalf for the good of the community, right? Now,
Skip,
he says,
Skip,
yes.
That Stern's translation is that. It says, for he is God's servant, therefore for your benefit.
Yeah, so he. The NASB translated as it because it is endorsing, the NASB is endorsing the idea of an institution of authority. Right. But the actual Greek is a noun in the masculine singular. So it's a person. Mm-hmm. Right? And I think Nanos is absolutely correct that Paul is not talking about some kind of institution. He's talking about the individuals within the Roman synagogue that the Gentiles need to be in submission to. Right? And why would Paul say that? Because as they submit to the authorities within the synagogue, they represent a positive view of what it means to be a messianic follower. Right? They're not, in other words, they're not coming in and trying to change the order. They're coming in and endorsing the order, which I think Paul needs them to do as a witness to the Messiah. Okay? So now there's this very interesting phrase about bearing the sword. And because it says bearing the sword, the church took this to mean the civil authority, because only the civil authority can enforce legislation, right? I mean, you can have lots of laws, but it's the government that can come to your house with a gun or a sword and make you do it. So when the church read this verse, they read it as though it meant that the government had the power to force you to comply. Okay? But so now we need to understand that term within the synagogue. And here's the interesting part about those words. Bears the sword is a third person singular. The Greek word used here is the equivalent of the Hebrew word used to describe the knife in circumcision from Joshua 5:2, and in the sacrificial knife used in offering Isaac in Genesis 2:26, a small dagger. It is not the Greek word to describe the typical military sword of the Roman soldier. Furthermore, this term is used symbolically as a sign for the judicial authority of God, right? So the whole point is, if Paul's talking about the civil authority and he says sword, we think of the power of the Roman government, right? The military. But he uses a word that doesn't even mean that. He uses a word that should be translated the circumcision knife or the sacrificial knife, not the military sword. And that changes the context, doesn't it? Because the sacrificial knife and the circumcision knife only make sense within the synagogue community. They don't make sense outside of the community, because the Roman government did not practice circumcision and certainly didn't recognize Isaac's sacrifice, right? So it makes a huge difference on how you understand this word sword. Yes, Linda, you had something to add?
I was just going to add about the people that were placed in power or in judges, the judges or the leaders were... But this is in the Talmud, they are to judge and to rule as if they are suspended and on a rope. And there is a sword at the top and a sword at the bottom, and they have a sword between their own legs. And therefore, they are to judge as fairly as possible because their own life, because they answer to God. So, I mean, yes. I'm not saying they do it. I'm stating that's how it's supposed to be done.
Right. And that makes perfect sense in Paul's view, because he views the synagogue authorities as the representative of God's will and judgment. So he says, if you Gentiles come into this community and you challenge the way that the community understands God's will, it will be as though you're resisting God, right? And then that will do two things. First, you'll create conflict in the community, which he doesn't want. And second, you'll diminish your claim that you are following Yeshua, who is Torah obedient, when you resist the very authorities that God's put in place in the synagogue. Right? Makes perfect sense from that context.
And those that judge are also being they also answer to the higher authority. So it's
right, exactly. Yep. Okay, so we're going to continue in verse 5 because look, here's Nanos's point. If chapter 12 is about Gentiles in the community, why isn't chapter 13 about the same thing? Why is it suddenly about the civil government? And my claim, of course, and Nanos' claim is it isn't. It's about people within the synagogue community, just like chapter 12 is, and just like chapter 14 will be. Okay? So now we're going to continue in 5. We're going to keep reading it as though we're reading about verses that belong to the community. And he says in 5, wherefore it's necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but because of conscience. So what is he saying inside? To be in subjection is the word in Greek, hupotasso. And hupotasso literally means to put in the proper order. It doesn't mean to be subservient. It doesn't mean to be forced under. It means to put in the proper order. So if you put people in the proper order in the synagogue, what does that mean? God will choose some to be in authority. He will choose some to represent the, you know, his will. He will choose some to be the scholars and learners in the community to help you understand the Halakha of Torah. He will choose some to be the diakonos, some to be the didaskalo. All those things that Paul talked about in chapter 12, all those gifts will show up because you're in proper order. So all he's saying in 5 is, remember what I told you in the previous chapter? Now look for it in the community. That's all he's saying, okay? And by the way, he says, if you don't look for that, if you don't do that, guess what's going to happen? The community is going to be disrupted. It's going to be chaotic. You're going to have conflict, which is not what I want. He says, you should do this. Even if you don't do it out of duty's sake, you should do it because of your conscience, because you know that what God wants in the synagogue community is harmony, right? That's how you witness to the world, okay? So 6. Now it looks like, from the Roman perspective, this is perfect from the church perspective, because it looks like, oh my gosh, Paul's telling you that you have to pay the Roman tax. And by the way, let's take this verse, apply it to today, and what does the church say? Well, make sure you pay all your taxes, which of course is the only thing the Romans were interested in. It's getting the money, okay? But we forget that in the first century, the Gentiles who are coming into the community don't know anything about the temple tax, which was still in place when Paul was writing, right? So there are taxes within the synagogue community that the Gentiles are completely ignorant of because they haven't been part of the Jewish community for all their lives. And what Paul is saying is, hey, listen, you pay your taxes, don't you? When you come into the temple, into the synagogue community, there's a temple tax. You pay it, right? And that, why do you pay that? Because you're part of the community. And that's what's expected. That's the norm of the community, right? So now, if you do that, why wouldn't you recognize that the rest of the things that are within the community, the expectations and ordinances within the community, also apply to you, right? Everyone in the assembly pays taxes. But to whom? They don't pay the taxes to Rome. They pay the taxes to God's community, right? So Uriel says, as it happens, you also pay taxes on account of this. Even they are servants of God. But who's even they? The tax collectors? Yeah, they're servants of God if they collect the temple tax because God required it out of the Torah. But they're not servants of God if they're the civil authorities that are collecting taxes on behalf of Caesar. All Paul say here is, you know, do what you're required to do according to the community that you're part of. Okay? All right. So look what he says in 6. For because of this, you also pay taxes. Your rulers italics in the NASB, which means the word isn't there, for they are servants of God. But clearly the civil authorities aren't devoting themselves to this very thing. What are they devoting themselves to? Making sure that the ordinances of God as understood by the Mosaic Code are being fulfilled, right? And 7, render to all what is due them. In other words, if you're a Gentile coming into the community and you're part of the synagogue community, don't say to the people in the community, well, look, I'm a Gentile. I'm not required to pay the Jewish temple tax. And Paul is saying, yes, you are. Because now you're part of that community. You belong to that community. So do what's expected of you within that community. Okay? And we're going to see how he expands this in the next chapter. Now let's continue. Tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Same process. What Paul's saying is, you're now entering into a community, you Gentiles, that you weren't a part of for all of your lives. They have a tradition and a history. Acknowledge it. Honor it. Do what's required of you within that community. And then 8, owe nothing to anyone except love for one another. Now, how can he say, owe nothing to anyone except love for one another, if he's just said, pay taxes, honor, respect, all that kind of stuff? Because the verse 7, 6 and 7 are about the expected norms of being in the community. But what's the underlying foundation of all of that? The underlying foundation is the next verse. Owe nothing to anyone except love for one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. Okay? So, O is the Greek word ophelio. It means to be under obligation, to have a debt. Okay? And this takes me right to Luzzatto. The ophela group is common in the New Testament, as used in Matthew, is close to that of Judaism. Jesus speaks often about people being debtors to God, but only in Matthew 6:12 is sin specifically equated with debt. Except for the love of one another, Paul's note on the comment of the fulfilling of the law. Torah is still the standard here. After all the theology in this group, the real standard is Torah. So if the standard of Torah shows up in verse 8, which is to love your neighbor as yourself, it obviously, from Paul's perspective, has to apply for the first 7 verses. Torah is always the measure that Paul uses, not the civil authority. Okay? So in 9.
Skip.
Yes.
Skip. What is the temple tax?
Ah, okay. So the temple tax was set up so that every, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Lindy, every male over the age of 20 paid a specific amount of money for the maintenance of the temple. And it didn't matter what your income or status in the community was. It was an absolutely level tax on everyone, which means that it was no more burdensome to the wealthy than the poor. And it was a tax that wasn't based on your financial well-being. It was simply a temple tax that was based on whether or not you were of the proper age and a male in the community. Is that correct? Oh,
I think it was a half a shekel. Everyone, half didn't shekel, you? Yes. Who you were, you paid a half a shekel. According to the temple rate, that everybody paid the same. A flat
everybody
tax.
Paid the same. And the reason that everybody paid the same is because it prevented the priests in the temple from excising more money from the wealthy than from the poor. It made everyone equal. Okay. It also limited the financial acquisition of the priesthood in the temple, right? So you couldn't get more than a half shekel per person, per male. That was it. You had to live within that budget, right? You weren't allowed to go out and ask for a special donation for the building fund, because God made sure that everyone was treated exactly the same. Okay?
So it has nothing to do with this 10% thing.
It has nothing to do with the what?
The 10%.
10%? Oh, no. You know where the 10% came from? It doesn't even come from the prophets, right? Often people say, okay, well, Malachi represents the last prophet and the 10%. No, that's not the case. The 10% literally came from the Catholic Church during the Holy Roman Empire. The Catholic Church owned almost all the property, and serfs worked the land. And the church required that they pay 10% of their produce to the church for rental of the land. Okay, that's where the 10% comes from.
Okay, so today it still stands the way the tax of the temple, the males bring in like...
Well, if you don't have a temple, there's no temple tax because there's no temple. If the temple were to be rebuilt, the temple tax would come back into play. But there are other assessments on the Jewish community that in addition to the temple tax, right? There are assessments based on the 7-year cycle. And it depends on which year in the cycle that you're in, that there are requirements for contribution to charity and to widows and orphans and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. So it isn't just that, it isn't just this temple tax. There's actually quite a few. I think the total is like 23% or something like that. But it's limited in its for what it can be used for. It can't be used for just anything, right? There's definitely requirements for how the funds should be used. And it and it's different over the 7 years, because in a 7 year cycle, there's 1 year when you have to leave the land fallow, when you're not supposed to be, mm-hmm. you know, getting produce and off the land, right?
I think it's Leviticus. You can find all of the different texts. We're just getting into it where you start this and you start, you bring in all of that, but
But for us, Paul's point is you're coming into a community which already has these norms. Don't think that they don't apply to you. They do, because you're voluntarily joining the community of the synagogue because you believe that Yeshua has opened the door for you to be connected to the God of Israel. So if you're connected to the God of Israel, you have obligation. So take care of the obligations. And then he says, underneath all of that, the foundation to all that is basically the verse Leviticus 19:18, love your neighbor as yourself, right? And since that foundation verse comes right from the Torah, all of the rest of this needs to be read in terms of Torah obedience, right? Okay, so let's go on to 9. He basically starts quoting from the Torah to show that you still need to be Torah obedient in all of your actions. For this, you should not commit adultery, you should not beat and murder, not steal, not covet. If there's any other commandments, it's summed up in the saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So he's saying, look, you can, all of the law is going to be fulfilled in this one act. Yes, Robin.
Sorry, Ingela was trying to say something to you, but there's no sound coming from her feed. We can't hear you, Ingela.
Sorry, yes, we can't hear you.
Making aware.
Yeah, I see your microphone is on, but I can't hear you. Sorry. I don't know what. If you could put it in the chat, then maybe I'll look at the. I can look at it in the chat.
She did.
It's in the chat.
Oh, it's in the chat. Okay, I didn't look at the chat yet.
It's verse 7.
What does customs mean? In verse 7. Okay, so he says, custom to custom. Okay, let's see what Uriel has to say there. 5, 6, 7. To him with the government fee, I think Uriel's made a big mistake by treating this as though he's talking about the government. The fee that to him respect. Render all to them what is due. Tax to them is due. Custom to whom custom. Okay, let me look really quickly. Hold on, and I'll see if I can tell you. Okay, custom. Okay. The word custom here comes from the word telos, which means the end result, the product. Okay. So in this case, he's saying basically to the one who requires you to fulfill. So it's not custom in the sense of duties, like we would think of financial. It's custom in the sense of your requirement to fulfill what's expected of you. Right. So if there's a custom, I'll give you an example. If there's a custom in the synagogue community that your child needs to be circumcised, your male child needs to be circumcised on the eighth day, fulfill it. You're a Gentile. You have a new baby boy on the eighth day. Fulfill the custom that needs to be completed for the synagogue community, right? Do the things that are expected. Do what is the fulfillment, the end purpose of that particular tradition. Okay? Okay, so let's proceed to 9. So 9, he basically says the same thing that he said in 8. You fulfill the whole law by literally fulfilling Leviticus 19:18, right? And then he says, love does no wrong to a neighbor. And I want to concentrate on this for a second because of the way Uriel translates this. So Uriel translates this verse as the love, the neighbor, never does evil work. That's literally what it means, okay? And Uriel translates this with the definite article, if I remember correctly. The act of love toward that neighbor results in zero injury, okay? But here, the Greek tense doesn't have the notion of that neighbor, an individual. It's much broader, right? So literally, as I said to you, it says literally the love, the neighbor. There's no equivalence there. There's no the love of the neighbor, the love for the neighbor. It's not like that at all. In fact, it's a very Hebraic expression where it leaves the copula, the verb, out. It basically says here's the deal. The love, the neighbor, fulfills the law. So you have to understand what Paul's saying from a Hebrew perspective because he doesn't include the verb, right? He basically says these two things are equivalent, right? In other words, he's saying exactly the same thing that Luzzatto is saying in Messali Yesharim. Your love for your neighbor is a direct reflection of your love for God, and I am allowed to witness the way that you treat your neighbor and see in that your love for God, right? You can't avoid the social responsibility and claim that you have a love for God if you treat your neighbor not the same as you would treat yourself, okay? So, it's not the act of love. It's the notion of trusting obedience to God is reflected, is precisely reflected in the way that you treat your neighbor. Okay? And I have a couple of comments about that we'll get to in a second. But I just want to get through the next couple of verses and then do a summary remark. Okay? 11. So, and do this, knowing the time that it is already the hour for you to awaken from sleep, for now salvation is nearer than it was before. Okay? And Uriel says, so here comes Paul's apocalyptic, right? And know this, that occasion, the hour to be resurrected out of sleep is already yours. The redemption that is in reality far closer to us than what we might have supposed. And of course, this is Paul's apocalyptic urgency. What he's saying is, listen, you Gentiles, there's not much time left for you to witness your commitment to the God of Israel through the Messiah. Get it done now, because as far as he's concerned, the Messiah is going to return. And when that happens, it'll be too late. It'll be too late for you to then decide, oh my gosh, I need to tell you that Yeshua is the Messiah. You need to demonstrate it right now because the time is short. Okay? And then he says, the night is almost gone. The day is at hand. Let us therefore lay aside the deeds of darkness and put on the armor of light. Okay? So now we've got a couple of interesting metaphors. Let's see. The deeds of darkness is ergo scotos. Ergo scotos, the works of darkness. And the armor of light is hoplon photos, which you know the word photo in Greek means light, okay? But think about the Hebrew context of this. All of this goes right back to Hebrew metaphors, right? The deeds of darkness, and Paul elaborates this a great deal in Galatians, but the whole point is this conflict between, or this dichotomy between dark and light shows up all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, the very first, second verse, right? That God is the author of light, and that the world without God, it falls into darkness and chaos. What does it say in Genesis 1:2? The face of the deep, right? That there was, that this Egyptian idea of the world of chaos underneath that's going to that's going to take over if we don't have order, if we don't have light, if we don't have some sovereign who can control it. All of that is built into Paul's idea of the metaphor or the metaphors of light and dark. Okay. And by the way, the Greek Gentiles would recognize this too, because Greek philosophy and Greek mythology uses the same kind of symbolic representations between dark and light. Okay. So now let's take a look at 13. Let us behave properly as in the day, not in carousing, drunkenness, sexual promiscuity, and sensuality, but in strife, not in strife and jealousy. So I want to just look at those words really quickly. Okay, behave properly. Okay, and as I pointed out in our original concept, behave properly means to walk, which is a completely Hebrew idea, right? To walk circumspectly. And of course, that means, I mean, look, in Hebrew, the idea of being Torah obedient is to walk according to God's ways. Okay, so Paul uses the Greek term, which recalls a Hebrew idea. Okay, and then he says, these are the following words that he says are don't belong. Carousing, komos, which means village festivals and reveling, right? So what he's saying is, look, Gentiles, there's a reason for you to come into this community to take on the norms of the Hebrew idea of festivals, but stop being part of the pagan world of debauchery and festivals, okay? Okay, drunkenness, which is the primary word, means intoxication. No issue there. Strife is a word that means quarrels. And jealousy, which is really interesting, right? It says strife and jealousy. And I would argue that strife, that jealousy, the word comes from zelos, which means to be, to have zeal, right? But it has both good and bad sense. Zeal in the sense of a fervent commitment to God's way is good, but zeal in the sense of envy, competition, contention, jealousy is the bad sense. So Paul's using the same word in a bad sense. Yes, Phyllis.
Why does he put in there sensuality?
Ah, okay. So let's back up just a second and see if I have that. Let me look. Hold on.
Says promiscuity and sensuality in the NASB.
Yeah, because he's talking about the things that belong to the Greek world that they're coming out of, and I just have to find out what the word is. Hold on just one second. What is this? Verse 13, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Sensuality. Okay, the word there is a word that means licentiousness. It means debauchery, right? In the sense of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's used the same word in 2 Peter 2:7 for Sodom and Gomorrah, and in Ephesians 4:19 for the pagan world. Sexual excess is probably meant in Galatians 5:19. And
so sensuality is the wrong word to use there then, because
sensuality is not the right word for an English translation today. It should be debauchery.
Yeah.
Okay, because he doesn't mean that you shouldn't feel things. He means that excess, where everything that you do is, is to your own personal pleasure. Okay, and the last one on 14. And this is we're going to finish today. So Uriel says, and this is important. In 14, Uriel's translation is, but instead, mimic Yeshua HaMashiach of our Lord. You are not to make room for physical body being overrun by cravings. Now, look what the NASB says. Put on Lord Jesus Christ, okay, and make no provision for the flesh. And we would read that in the same way that we think Paul uses the flesh in the rest of his letter. But it's not. The way that he uses flesh in the rest of his letter, translated the same way in English, is the word sarx. But here the word is soma, which means body. Okay, so the English translation should read, and make no provision for the body in regard to its lusts, cravings. And I think Uriel is right on track when he says, don't make any room for the physical body being overrun with cravings. We're not talking about sarx, which is the flesh of, in contrast to the spirit, Paul's not using that Greek term, right? So he's saying, don't let your yitzhak hara take over the operation of your physical well-being. Okay? And for this, I have two notes. And here they are. They're going to be in the additional material, but I'm going to read them to you. They're both from Luzzatto. Consciousness is not driven by needs. It is impelled by the freedom to choose between two alternatives, a choice that is satisfying initially. But whether it is indeed the right choice requires reflection. And reflection requires study, which is the application of reason in its truest sense. We do not use our intelligence to reflect on our choices. It is as though our consciousness becomes invisible. If we do not use our intelligence to reflect, our consciousness becomes invisible. We mistake our making any choice at all for making the correct choice, since it is the other person to whom we are responsible. Our choices regarding our neighbors will eventually define the visibility or invisibility of our consciousness to ourselves. Okay, so this is, I think, where Paul's going. Well, he's saying, look, don't let your yitzhak hara determine how you act in the world. Remember Leviticus 19:18, that you are ultimately responsible to your neighbor for the fulfillment of the law, which means that when it comes to making a decision, you should not allow the yitzhak hara to determine what is the right action. You must measure your action in terms of its impact on the neighbor. Okay? And Luzzatto goes on to say, it is not the choice itself that satisfies our consciousness need for freedom, but the choice to obey the obligations to pursue another's good. In the last citation, our yitzhak hara is part and parcel of our very constitution. It is the record of every disappointment, every rejection, and every failure we've ever faced. It is even the echo of the disappointment, rejection, and the failure that reaches us from beyond our self-enclosure, from the lives of those others who had a share in bringing us into being. This accumulation of pain is justifiably called the yitzhak hara, which pushes us to obscure the view of the other in our souls through the diversions of everyday life. The self-awareness required to confront the yitzhak hara is the heart of the trait of watchfulness. And what Paul is saying is, listen, don't make room in your physical well-being so that you are driven by the needs of the yitzhak hara. Make room for fulfilling the law through caring about what happens to your neighbor. And that's why you can say Leviticus 19:18 is the fulfillment of the entire law, because it's focused outside of you, not inside of you. Makes a huge difference, okay? And now we see that chapter 13, which looks like it starts with the government of the civil authorities, ends up in the synagogue environment for witness to Torah obedience. So the whole chapter is still about what happens inside the synagogue community. And 14 is just going to reinforce that, because now he's going to start talking about the practical aspects of eating, of drinking, what days you celebrate, all that stuff within the synagogue community. Okay? All right. What do you comments? We're going to do 14 tomorrow. Comments, questions? You can see what an enormous difference this makes in the way that we interpret what Paul says if we remove it from the 2,000 years of the church. It makes a huge, huge difference. Yep. Dave, I can't hear you.
Yeah, this is like a breath of fresh air in a world of corruption from 2,000 years of being off center.
Yeah. It says, listen, Paul's purpose here is focused entirely on what happens in the synagogue, not on what happens in the outside world. In the outside world, opposition to God is still opposition to God, and there is no endorsement of a civil government by God.
Yeah, I mean, it makes perfect sense, because he's talking to the Jews and Gentiles the whole beginning. Why would he suddenly start talking about the Roman government? It doesn't fit at all.
Yeah, absolutely. It makes perfect sense. I think Nanos is right on track. And when we start reading that way, then we just have to make sure that, like Uriel's translation, we don't take administration to mean civil administration. It has to be within the synagogue community. And by the way, what does that tell you about how you act in the world today? It tells you that inside your religious community, these things apply. Outside the religious community, you're supposed to still stand with God in opposition to the government that opposes him. It doesn't give one iota of justification for claiming that you need to be in compliance with the civil government.
Well, not only that, he's an apocalyptic writer, so he's all worried about the end. You know, he wouldn't be worried Absolutely. About what happens with the government. Yep. I mean, outside in Rome.
Yep, he's saying, listen, we don't have time to worry about what's going to happen in the civil government because it's all going to end, right? So get with it, right?
So,
now, the
yeah.
fact is, 2,000 years later, the advice still applies. It's just that we can't read it in terms of Paul's endorsement for the government that we live in. Yeah, please.
We're still bound to having to be the slaves of the government and pay our taxes to them. We're still, I mean, if you don't, you'll be punished. They'll come after you. So we're still their slaves. So, I mean, there's no freedom. We're still, yeah, slaves.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, that's in one sense, that's absolutely true because you're part of a society, right? And you're going to be under the edicts of the society, even if they stand in opposition to God. But we have plenty of examples in the Tanakh of people who stood up against that. But the important thing for Paul here is what happens inside the community. He's not talking about what happens outside the community. He doesn't even address that. What he's saying is, inside the community, don't have this kind of conflict. Don't have this opposition. Understand that you are the newcomers to a tradition, a history that's been going on for thousands of years, God's people, and you need to adapt to them. And we're going to see in 14, he gets very literal, and he says, listen, you Gentiles, if you think you've come in under grace and you don't have to worry about the law, you're dead wrong, right?
Right.
You've now adopted the community, so become part of it, right?
Is it still the same in synagogues today that the rulers that are there, that whole dynamic of authority and submission in the synagogues today, does that reflect the way it was 2,000 years ago also?
I don't know. I know that, Bob and I spent a lot of time trying to think if we know any religious assembly in the entire world that represents the four kinds of communities that were involved in Paul's time, and we couldn't think of a single one. Because the what's happened, of course, is that as a result of the history of the way that the church has handled this, it's forced more and more separation when we should have been dealing with more and more unification, right? So the different groups are now as far divided as they've ever been over issues of theology and everything else that never was a part of what the first century disciples were trying to accomplish. It's hard to imagine that we could have got any further away from what was really happening in those early days.
Because in Acts, you know, when Paul and Silas are kicked out of the synagogues for preaching about Yeshua, was that not part of not being submitted to the authority of the synagogue in their preaching? And that's why they kicked them out, or that's why they arrested them or gave them problems?
I think that they were excluded because they couldn't accomplish what Paul couldn't accomplish what he's trying to accomplish here, which is that the Messianic community had to act in such a way that the Jews would recognize that the Messiah had come and that the door was open. The Orthodox community, even in, not all, obviously not all the Orthodox community, some part of the Orthodox community, even in the letter to the Galatians, opposed that, violently opposed it, so much so that Peter basically was... not willing to stand with Paul against that idea and removed himself from table fellowship in order not to cause any friction. And Paul really took him to task for that. But it's a small group of the Orthodox community that held on to the idea that you could not become a part of the synagogue unless you converted to Judaism through all the official steps, right? And Paul argues against that his entire life.
Yeah.
But here in Romans, it appears that maybe he's, I don't know how to put it, he's hitting pay dirt on his ideas. Something seems to be going through.
Yeah, I think that in the Romans assembly, there were Gentiles. And now what he's saying is, listen, before I get there, I want you to recognize the responsibility that you have as a Gentile to the Orthodox Jewish community. Don't do things that cause problems for the Orthodox Jewish community, or they will miss out on understanding that Yeshua is the Messiah. Right? That's his intention. Yeah, Robin, did you have something you want to add?
Well, I just wanted to ask then, do we have to hold what we're coming to understand in Romans 13 in tension with what Peter says in 1 Peter 2 about submission to authorities?
Yeah, it's the same idea, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right? You don't think that Peter is saying something about civil government when Paul, who uses the same words, is saying something about synagogue environment, right? We have to look
I'm looking at that text, and it seems that Peter uses different terminology. He talks about the king. He talks about governors. At one point, he seems to even talk about the emperor.
Okay, so we'll have to go back to the Greek text, see what the words are, see what their connection is to the Hebrew idea, and see what audience he's writing to. Because clearly, Paul is writing to a Gentile population within a synagogue community. Is that what Peter's audience is? I don't know. We have to find out.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Yep. Anything else? No?
I'm just... I keep thinking of the gospel accounts and just of how Yeshua is really shifting the paradigm of what the Messiah is going to do, what he looks like, his interpretation of the scripture. When we were talking about the tax, I remember Peter, I guess he's the temple officials say, you know, don't you pay the temple tax? And
this
personal engagement.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, yes, I mean, teachers that I've been involved with have said, well, you know, this proves that only Peter was over 20 because it was only a shekel for both of them. Like they completely missed the point that he's being Torah observant.
Yes.
You know, there's so many things that are just
glaring
around me.
At the moment, I'm reading this really interesting book, right? Jesus of Nazareth by Joseph Klausner. So here is a guy who is a completely Jewish recognized scholar. He died some time ago, but he wrote a book, and basically the entire intent of the book is to determine who Jesus is from Hebrew documents. So he goes through the Talmud, he goes through the Amorim, the Tamilim, goes through all these different sources in Hebrew to say, okay, so what does that tell us? And it's really fascinating because he's not coming up with the typical, you know, Jesus stands in opposition to Judaism. In fact, just the opposite. And it's really, really fascinating. I'll let you know when I finish it what the conclusions are. But he still, you know, he talks about the gospel accounts, but he recognizes that they were written many years after all of the events occurred. And so he's trying to make his way through all the scholarship so that he can come up with a portrait of Yeshua that actually fits the Hebrew context. It's really, really interesting stuff. And one of the things is going to be, does Yeshua act in ways that would ever offend the Orthodox community? And we'll see. How it works.
Well, and he does, right? They want to throw him out of this. They want to kill him when he's teaching.
It depends on which community you're talking about. You know, he makes a big point out of the fact that the Galilean community was very different than the community in Jerusalem, and that the Jerusalem orthodoxy was far more attached to the status quo than the Galilean version, which out of which a lot of radical prophets and everything came. So here's a Jewish guy who's recognizing that these differences show up in our, you know, in our New Testament texts, right? Lindy?
I was just going to say that is no different than today.
Yeah.
It's absolutely no different than today. And just two groups, you can take it from two groups. You can take the Ashkenazi and the Sephardic, and it's too much to go into the difference, but it just is this, nothing's changed.
Yes.
Yeah. Suffice it to say, nothing's changed.
Yeah, well, the rabbi that I meet with in Parma here is Ashkenazi. And he and I have really interesting discussions about the Ashkenazi interpretation of the text and the Sephardic interpretation of the text. You know, division has been part of religion since the beginning. And what Paul is arguing, of course, here is, look, Gentiles, don't make it any more difficult than it already is. Right?
Okay. Anyway, all right. Thank you. I just thought I'd throw that comment in there.
Yeah. I'll see. Oh, Pam, do you have something to say?
I just have a question.
Yes.
Because of the exodus of everybody in California, the Messianic community has dwindled down to nothing almost. And so people are going back to church just for fellowship. How do we interpret this under those conditions?
Well, going back to church for fellowship, I think, is a perfectly legitimate thing. You want people who are still at least in principle, worshiping the God of the Bible.
Exactly.
I think what has to happen is that, look, you can't have conversation with people who think you're inherently opposed to them. So
right.
I think this is Paul's strategy as well. Look, you Gentiles, come into the community and become part. And then you have the right to speak. So if I end up in the church, the last thing I'm going to do is stand up in the back and say, you know, your interpretation of all this is wrong and you've missed this Hebrew word and you don't understand this and on, because no one will pay attention. But if I end up in the church and I show that I'm charitable and I show that I'm willing to serve and I show that I have a heart for the community that the church serves, all those kinds of things give me the status that I need in order to say, hey, have you ever thought about this? But that takes a long time, right? It takes friendship comes before proselytizing.
Exactly. Okay.
Although, Skip, that didn't work for you real well here in a lot of situations.
Well, no, it's because, you know, the very fact that I'm there is a threat to most people because of the academics, right? But if I don't tell people about my academic background, then at least I can have some conversation with people, right? So that helps. I mean, you know, the whole point is reduce the threat so that people are willing to converse. You have to get past the willingness stage, right? That's the whole point. Right? Okay. Anyway, we'll look at 14 tomorrow, okay?